Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, it's great to see Obama back out there, meeting with the voters, really connecting, raising a lot of money.
Ron, it's Michelle Obama who's out there doing that.
Oh, I see. It is Michelle.
It is.
Well, she's very popular, too.
She is going to at least five states, all of which have key Senate races, Wisconsin, Colorado, Illinois, Washington, California.
Five that all are currently in Democratic hands.
Right, five states. And that's, of course, is Russ Feingold's seat, the seat formerly held by President Obama.
In Illinois.
Patty Murray in Washington, Barbara Boxer, and
Michael Bennett in Colorado.
And Michael Bennett in Colorado, right.
So those now, these are all five seats that the Democrats really didn't think they were going to be in any trouble in starting of the year.
Certainly not California or Washington or Wisconsin, actually.
No, absolutely not. Russ Feingold was more or less in the clear when Tommy Thompson decided not to run, and yet now that's a toss-up on just about everybody's list. And he's a little behind in most polls in the state.
But here's a comparison, though. I mean, Betty Ford was very popular and did some Republican events in 1976.
Oh, and that helped them a lot in 1974, didn't it?
No, that's exactly the point. Betty Ford, Barbara Bush. So we could always talk about the popularity of a first lady, and Michelle Obama is popular, but ultimately I don't think is going to determine these Senate races. But what I thought was most interesting to me about President Obama's week was the town hall meeting televised by CNBC last week. If anything is emblematic of what's troubling the Democrats in 2010, I thought it was right here. It's not for people to yell out, like you hear on Fox TV, mm-hmm. that he's a socialist mm-hmm. or he's not a real citizen, but from people who supported him and believed in him and talked about how disappointed they were in him and how much they're fatigued and exhausted in trying to defend him.
I've been told that I voted for a man who said he was going to change things in a meaningful way for the middle class. I'm one of those people, and I'm waiting, sir. I'm waiting.
I think the most telling
that
problem.
That one particular woman who spoke up and has become kind of an emblematic figure in this, so much so that a lot of people were asking whether or not she was in some sense or another a plant. It turns out, interviewed afterwards, she said that she was surprised at how her question had played, that she still supported Obama and still planned to vote for him and was going to vote Democratic this fall. But she was expressing something, you're quite right, that is quite real, and that is a sense of disappointment on a lot of Democrats' part that does not really make them enthused about voting in November. They're feeling a lot of this kind of uncertainty, and certainly with respect to the economy, lots of question marks, and they're not particularly jazzed about going out and voting for those question marks.
She apparently will, but not everybody will. And there's a new Pew poll out that basically talks about how even independents are not so enthused about the Democratic Party.
Yes, this is really the heart of the Democrats' problem. They've got a turnout problem among their own voters, for sure. They've got a lot of extraordinarily excited Republicans on the other hand, and those are problems. But their real problem, their biggest problem, is that the independent voters who were their afterburners in 2006 and 2008 are turning around and expressing a great deal of disillusionment, saying not only that they're tired of a sluggish recovery, but they think the president's policies are actually hurting the recovery in some cases. And whether they're people who are proclaimed independents, you know, self-described independents who really almost always vote Republican, or whether they're the kind who really almost always vote Democratic or somewhere in the middle, in all the different categories that the Pew Research Center identified, these typologies of these independent voters, all of them are, in one way or another, some kind of bad news for the Democratic candidates.
Now, hoping to capitalize on this disillusionment on the Democratic side is the Republican Party, and I don't think we've seen this much excitement with the Republicans, at least since 94, when Newt Gingrich and company unveiled their contract with America, and now we have a similar situation with the Republicans this year.
This is the first time since 1994 that the Republicans have had no part of the federal establishment. They don't have the presidency. They don't have either chamber of Congress. They don't have anything. They have to defend, in a sense, in Washington. They can be against the entirety of Washington, and it's come along at a time when Washington is at a low ebb of popularity. So in an attempt to nationalize, if you will, that kind of energy, the House Republican leadership came out this week with something they call their Pledge to America, riffing obviously on the contract with America from 1994, which in popular imagination had something to do with how Newt Gingrich managed to capture 52 net seats for the Republicans that fall and take control of the House.
Yeah, I'm not convinced if people actually heard of the contract with America before the 94 election.
The polls showed they hadn't, but they had heard of it maybe 6 months later or a year later, because so much of 1995 was devoted in the House to passing the elements of the contract and arguing about it, and then of course a lot of them died in the Senate, and some of them ran into problems with the Supreme Court. But there was a lot of talk of the contract thereafter. The question is whether or not hardly anyone really had heard of it before Election Day, and it was responsible for electing them.
One big difference between now and 1994 is the Republicans don't have a Newt Gingrich kind of leader that will take them to the promised land.
Although, well, not if you need a leader. If you need a Moses to get to the
promised
land.
Well, you know something? In 1994 they did because they were out of power for 40 years. They're only out of power for a couple of years here, so it's not that they need a Moses. But at the same time, I also don't see the kind of specifics.
The contract was incredibly specific. I mean, they had eight things they could do on the very first day, just House rules that they changed, and they did that. Then there were 10 elements that included some pretty heavy-duty stuff, term limits on members of Congress, a balanced budget amendment for the federal government. And I'm not seeing the same kind of thing here. This pledge seems to be, we pledge to be for tax cuts, we pledge to be for smaller government, we pledge to be for spending caps. And these are all things Republicans have been for as long as I can remember.
Yeah, but I think having it on paper is the Republicans' way of saying, how dare you say that we have no agenda? Here's our agenda. It's right here in black and white. But if anybody hasn't decided to vote Republican by now, they're not going to do it by seeing this pledge.
Oh, we'll find somebody somewhere on cable TV. Someone will crop up and say,
"That's what
I've been a lifelong Democrat, and I was a huge Barack Obama supporter, but I just read the Republicans' pledge to America, and I'm changing my loyalties right here and now."
And that was Larry Summers.
You know, the fall of Larry Summers at exactly the same time as the war over Elizabeth Warren. The question is raised about Elizabeth Warren, who is going to be an advisor to the president rather than the actual appointed head of the new Consumer Protection Agency.
Why is that?
Because she could not be confirmed in the Senate, where right now they cannot get an agreement as to what the time on the clock is.
On anything.
No, the Republicans have blocked action on everything, right, with one or two Democrats sometimes helping them, one or two Republicans sometimes defecting. But it's essentially all the Republicans against virtually all the Democrats, and they have brought the Senate chamber to a halt. Okay, easy joke. How can they tell? If you've been watching C-SPAN any time in the last several centuries, you know the Senate is a slow-moving institution. But they have brought it to a total stop, and they can do that with impunity because it clearly has not captured the public imagination as an issue that they have done it.
Isn't it remarkable, though, that you think of all the things that the Republicans passed with 52, 53 senators, and yet the Democrats with 59 senators with some dissensions, they just can't get anything done. And you wonder, in the next Senate, the best-case scenario for the Democrats may be 52 Democratic senators.
Best case, maybe 52 or 3.
Yeah, 53, 52.
I would guess 50 to 52.
Yeah, and what gets done in that Senate?
Well, nothing, obviously. Yeah. But then, on the other hand, nothing's getting done in this Senate. So clearly there has to be a change of mind and heart on the part of individual senators to say, enough. This kind of warfare is deleterious to the ability of Congress and the country to function. We have to figure out how to restore some of the old Senate cooperation across the aisle. If that means five or six people getting together, as we have seen in the past, the gang of 14 was seven from one party, seven from another party, and they got past filibustering of judges. That can happen if goodwill exists. I think when we look back on this 2 years, we're going to say pushing out to 60 votes in the Senate for the Democrats ultimately cost them their ability to get anything done.
You said that at the time.
It's
careful what you wish for.
Exactly. Right. It spoiled the way the Senate works, and the Senate didn't have another way to work. But maybe if they had 65 or 70 votes, maybe. But at just barely 60, that doesn't work because one Democrat can always take it away from you.
We've seen this year that Republicans who have attempted to cross over and work with Democrats, either Bob Bennett in Utah.
Or Lisa Murkowski
in Alaska.
Mike Castle in the House.
Mike Castle, certainly. And even Lindsey Graham, who's not up this year, has been censured by his local Republican Party.
Censured by his own home party.
And on the Democratic side, we saw Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas, who had to fend off a tough opponent from her left because she voted Republicans so many times. Something this week, we saw the same thing with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And in the past, Susan Collins has made it clear that she supports repealing the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And yet, when the defense authorization bill came up, she voted with every other Republican to say
she had an argument. She could say, I don't think some of the issues they're putting on this bill should be there unless we get to add amendments on any subject too, and the Democrats won't let us do that. Some dispute over whether or not they would. But she believed the Democrats wouldn't allow such amendments. So she said, I'm going to object to bringing the bill to the floor. She could also have been responding to the obviously incredible pressure being put on her to join the rest of her Republican colleagues in effectuating this roadblock, which has really empowered the minority enormously all through this year and now in this fall and these last waning days of this Congress, has empowered them totally. Yeah, they can shut the institution down, turn out the lights.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what's going to happen, what the political landscape is going to look like in 2014 when Susan Collins is up again. But the thought of a Susan Collins or Olympia Snowe, who's up in 2012, with this Tea Party fervor out there, I can't imagine how either they survive a Republican primary or they stay Republican, because ultimately, if Lisa Murkowski and Bob Bennett were not conservative enough, then I can't see how Snowe and Collins survives. We can talk about the fact that all the Republicans stuck together on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but on the Democratic side, they didn't have unanimity either. Blanche Lincoln was among the two Democratic senators who voted also against the repeal of it, and Blanche Lincoln, who's badly trailing in the polls in Arkansas.
Very badly.
Again, it's one of those profiles and courage things. Do you want to stand up and say, look, this is what my party believes in, I'm going to go with this, and go down to defeat, or try to...
She's going to go down to defeat.
So if she is going to go down, and I think it's true. So
yeah.
Either way, why not stand up for something you may or may not believe
in?
Well,
maybe
who knows
it isn't what... Yeah, maybe it isn't what she believes in. And it's always very difficult to say whether it's Susan Collins or whether it's Blanche Lincoln when they are responding to the obvious pressures that are being put on them and when they may actually have some conviction as they purport to have. Another thing the Senate did not vote on this week that is of great significance to many people is the Campaign Finance Disclosure Act, which they... pretty much been trying to do for a number of months now since the Supreme Court ruled that corporations could re-enter the financial...
The Citizens United decision, right?
That's right. That corporations and unions could re-enter the fray. Really, the big players, though, as we head into the final 6 weeks of this season, the big players are these independent groups, somewhat shadowy, if you will. We don't really know, in some cases, who their donors are or all their donors. And they are spending suddenly a lot of money, $17 million, not counting any primary spending. They have already spent $17 million on the general election on the side of the Republicans, and corresponding groups favoring Democratic candidates but not directly tied to the party or the candidate have spent only one-seventh that amount.
When the Supreme Court made that decision, a lot of people felt that 2010 would be too soon to see anything. We'll really see the effect of it in 2012.
That may be true, but we're seeing it even now.
We are, and very late in the campaign, it's almost like at the last second, saving up their best for the last. And it's certainly, we always talk about how much the DNC is outraising the RNC, and the other congressional committees are better for the Democratic Party, but these independent, so-called independent groups are really not stacking the deck, but they're certainly favoring the Republican Party. That's going to make, I suspect, in key House Senate races will make a big difference in November.
So let's talk about some of those races. Good news again this week in new polls for Republicans in Senate races.
Well, in Pennsylvania, we saw Pat Toomey, who's the Republican, against Joe Sestak. The Democrat is for Arlen Specter's seat. Sestak beat Specter in the primary. The last time Quinnipiac did this race, it was basically a toss-up. It was tied. And now Toomey seems to have opened up a 4-5, 6-point lead over Sestak. Again, a lot of people thought that Toomey might be too conservative for Pennsylvania.
He was in the past.
Well, he never ran. The only time he ran,
he ran against Specter.
And he barely lost the Republican primary. But think of Rick Santorum in 1994, very conservative, perhaps maybe the only year, although he was reelected in 2000.
In 2006, then, he got clobbered for being too conservative. Just bad timing.
But if this is another 1994 for the Republican Party, especially in Pennsylvania, where I suspect they'll take back the governorship as well.
That seems clear.
Toomey looks like he'll win that seat, too. And there's another poll in Arkansas.
And that poll shows Blanche Lambert Lincoln really pretty much gone. There are also new polls coming in from some of the other Senate races we're watching. Wisconsin looks like a dead heat. Some polls have Russ Feingold, the incumbent Democrat, slightly ahead. Other polls have him slightly behind. But that's certainly not one that the Democrats look likely to put away between now and November. And that was part of their firewall at one time.
On the other hand, there's bad news for the Republican Party in Delaware. Once upon a time, this was a GOP pickup, a gimme for Mike Castle. It's not a gimme anymore. Christine O'Donnell, the Republican nominee, has her past statements about witchcraft are just, you know, beyond...
Unfortunately made on Bill Maher's television show.
Because I dabbled into witchcraft, I hung around people who were doing these things.
Having fun?
I'm not making this stuff up. I know what they told me they did.
Well, what they doing?
I mean, and one of my dates One of my dates,
about the public.
First dates.
Wait, I want to hear about this.
One of my first dates with the witch was on a satanic altar, and I didn't know it. And I mean, there's little blood and stuff like that.
That was a date. Your first date was a satanic altar.
Yeah, we went to a movie and then like had a little midnight picnic.
What type of movie and a sacrifice?
On the other hand, she's got $2 million now. She didn't used to have.
She does, and you don't need that much money to run statewide in Delaware. But at the same time, there's a poll that just had Chris Coons, the Democratic nominee, up 15 points.
Could Chris Coons be identified on the street even in Newark, Delaware, or Wilmington?
No, but Christine O'Donnell can. That's perhaps the reason why he's up 15 points.
No, he's not a particularly striking-looking human being.
Neither was Joe Biden in 72.
All right, I'm just saying that there is this mojo going on. There is this extraordinary energy running, even in Delaware, usually a Democratic/independent kind of state. And while she's way down in the polls at this point, and while she's still explaining foolish remarks she made in the 90s, she is not out of it at this point because she was out of it and came from nowhere back in August and September. I mean, we can still see more surprises in this season. She would seem to be completely a bridge too far. She would seem to be someone with zero qualifications. No job, no home, no family, nothing to show for herself except a lot of activity to try to get herself in the media over the years, which is coming back to bite her. That would not seem a winning formula. I'm just saying in this year, it has become impossible to call anything impossible.
Well, look at Carl Palladino in New York. I mean, once upon a time, he was completely laughed at by the media, ridiculed by his own party.
Dismissed.
Well, no, we've been dismissed by a lot of people, too. He had to petition to get on the Republican Party ballot. And here he is. Not that Rick Lazio was a world beater, but he was the only thing that the Republican establishment, whatever that means in New York, had. And yet he beat him handily.
In the primary.
Carl Palladino, we had him on Talk of the Nation this week. He is a Howard Beale. If there's such a thing as a Howard Beale character, that is Carl Palladino.
If we've learned anything tonight, it's that New Yorkers are as mad as hell. And we're not going to take it anymore.
But we're in the state of New York now.
Right.
And Andrew Cuomo is a reasonably popular Democrat.
He is, but he also can get in the gutter with the best of them. He is not beloved by the media. And so this latest Quinnipiac poll that came out that showed him
6 points ahead
over Palladino. I mean, a lot of people said, whoa, the aura of his inevitability is gone. I don't think that's really going to happen. I think Cuomo wins big.
But it's a better story to say the aura of his inevitability is gone.
Right.
Is it not? Also, another factor in New York, I believe Rick Lazio has the opportunity to still be on the ballot.
He is the Conservative Party nominee. And of course, if he wants to stay on the November ballot, he can do that. And so far, when Ed Cox, Richard Nixon's son-in-law, who is the chairman of the state Republican Party, said, look, I want Rick Lazio to get off the ballot, he says, I could care less what Ed Cox has to say and what the rest of the Republican leadership has to say, because they didn't do him much good when he was the so-called Republican choice for the nomination.
Okay, a certain bitterness there on the part of Rick Lazio, who thought he was going to be the Republican nominee. A little bit like Lisa Murkowski, the incumbent Republican senator in Alaska, who has actually been essentially dismissed from the leadership in the Senate because she's still running as a write-in candidate back in Alaska, despite losing the primary to Joe Miller.
She didn't sound as angry as some rejected candidates have in the past, but she said, look, Joe Miller, according to Lisa Murkowski, is too extreme. Scott McAdams, the Democratic mayor of Sitka, who's the Democratic nominee, is just a nice guy, but he's going nowhere.
Is he the mayor of actually Sitka or some of the suburbs around Sitka? I mean, he's the mayor of the whole metropolitan Sitka
area? No, he is the whole thing of Sitka.
Okay.
Yeah. Matter of fact, it covers the entire Hammer and Sitka area.
And as we know, everyone in Alaska can see Russia from their porch.
And everybody in Florida can see another three-way race going in their Senate race. Marco Rubio, the longtime Republican nominee, Kendrick Meek, the Democratic nominee, Charlie Crist, the independent. Latest polls show Rubio pulling away. We always thought that there would be between
close
Rubio and Crist, with Meek certainly last place. But Rubio looks like he's going to hold that seat, held for most of one term by Mel Martinez.
Yes, the old Mel Martinez.
Who quit last year. And then, of course, we had now held by the very famous George Lemieux.
George Lemieux.
But before I bid you a Lemieux for the podcast, two things I want to talk about. One is in Illinois, Jesse Jackson Jr., the congressman, son of the civil rights leader, who made it clear in 2008 that he was interested in President Obama's Senate seat. The Chicago Sun-Times reports this week that a businessman told the FBI that the businessman offered
to Blagojevich to raise
$6 million for Blagojevich's campaign fund if Jackson would be appointed to the Senate. Jackson denies this. He says it's rubbish. But we know that Jackson's Senate career is all but finished, but he still has interest in the Chicago mayoral race, which is next year, which Richard Daley is giving up. But two other people who have taken out candidate papers this week, former Senator Carol Moseley Braun.
Very interesting.
And Congressman Danny Davis, who has run for mayor before.
Two other African-American prospects.
From Chicago, right. So they're both talking about running for mayor. And the other thing I want to say before we left was the end of the primary season in Hawaii.
The 50th state. Winds up the final primary season,
the final state. What's interesting in that state is, one, of course, it's President Obama's alleged birthplace. He got 72% of the vote there in 2008. But at the same time, they have a Republican governor. They have a Republican congressman, Charles Jou, D-J-O-U.
Both of those offices are thought to be vulnerable to, hey, imagine this, a Democratic
takeover
in 2010.
In this Republican year, it looks like the Democrats could take back that seat that Abercrombie once held, and Linda Lingle, the Republican governor who's term limited, the Democrats may win that back too, but it's almost fitting that if the Democrats are going to have any good state, it'll be in the state of President Obama's birth.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics. And you should visit our new It's All Politics website, where my political junkie column, Ron Elving's Watching Washington column.
You said it right.
Yeah, can be there in its fullest, and including Scuttlebutt. You know something? This is a beef I have. How come we never mention Scuttlebutt on this podcast?
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rubin.
Join us again next week. For It's All Politics from NPR.
It's witchcraft. And I've got no defense for it. The heat is too intense for it. What good would common sense for it do?